everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for you today. My guest will be Michael Abelman. He is the author of many books. His latest one is called Street Farm, Growing Food, Jobs, and Hope on the Urban Frontier. And he is a real visionary, and I'm really excited to tell you more about him in a little bit and invite him on to share his story with all of us. But first, I want to share with you some news in and around the city, some things going on, and, of course, my weekly recipe. Last week, I hope you enjoyed the show with Richard Schwartz. I pre-recorded that because I went away with my family to Peru. We actually hiked part of the Inca Trail and visited Machu Picchu, some of the Inca ruins, all through that amazing country. And I took a vegetarian cooking class with a chef. His name was Chef Rene from Tawa Restaurant. And that was a lot of fun, and I hope to be sharing some of those recipes with you over the next coming weeks. And next month he'll actually come on my show as a guest as well. So I'm back to my homestead, and I was so glad I got so many seeds in before I left because they are sprouting and growing. We actually had our first salad from the garden this past week, and the gardens are just looking great. I love this time of year. It's so much fun, a lot of hard work, but it's just beautiful to look around and see everything growing, and it's just such a healthy time. So I feel like after the winter, I come out of the dark ages, and I get reborn every year when it's springtime. It's just lovely. So anyway, lots of things are going on in the city that I want to share with you before I get into some of the news stuff. Starting tomorrow, June 9th and 10th, Stony Brook campus of Stony Brook University, their Southampton campus, is hosting a food lab conference. And this is 50 years of food in America. There's going to be lots of celebrity chefs there, farmers, food producers. It's all, you know, all day Saturday, Friday and Saturday. It's $100. There's still tickets left. It should be a great thing. $75 for students or farmers. Check it out. It's called 50 Years of Food in America at Stony Brook in Southampton. And it should be a great event. Also this weekend on Sunday, June 11th, Ellen Kamai, who is also a show host on PRN, is an incredible, knowledgeable woman when it comes to medicinal herbs, and she will be giving a medicinal herb walk and medicine-making workshop out at Restoration Farm on Sunday at 11 a.m. You can go to her website, Ellen Kamai, or Restoration Farms to register for that. Sunday, June 11th, there's the Long Island Climate Summit, and that is being organized by Food and Water Watch and some other nonprofits, and it's going to take place at the Sisters of St. Joseph in Brentwood. And this is from noon to 5, and it's pulling together people that really care about the climate and trying to give us all tips on how to be leaders and activists in protecting our communities against climate change. Also on Sunday, June 11th, there is a farm tour at Homecoming Farm, which is in Amityville. And they also will be talking about their CSA, Community Supported Agricultural Program there. If you're interested, go on to the Homecoming Farm website. June 12th, Good Food Spotlight Network and Meeting Place. And this is taking place in Long Island City at the Entrepreneur Space. And it's a networking opportunity from 6 to 9 to meet other entrepreneurs working within food and sustainability. So that should be interesting. June 13th, there's a documentary screening out at the Unitarian Church in Manhasset at Shelter Rock. And this is a free screening of a new powerful documentary called The Hudson, A River at Risk, also sponsored by the Unitarian Church's Green Sanctuary Committee and by Food and Water Watch. And there will be a discussion following. So if you can make that, it's at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church on Shelter Rock Road in Manhasset. Slow Food South Shore is having a membership drive drive at the Wildside Organic Bistro next Thursday, June 15th from 6 to 9. If you're on the South Shore of Long Island, you want to do that. They are trying to grow their membership. They're a new chapter. Slow Food North Shore, which is the one that I run, has been around now for about 10 years. And we are having two great events coming up next weekend. First, we're having a tour of the Brooklyn Grange rooftop farm in Long Island, in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And then we'll go to the next building and have a tour of Rooftop Red Organic Vineyard. They're actually growing grapes up on the roof, and we're going to have a wine tasting, and then a local gourmet pizzeria will be delivering pizzas and salads to us, and we'll have a little dinner party up on the roof overlooking Manhattan. So that should be a great event, $40 for Slow Food members, $50 for others. And then the following night on June 17th, Slow Food North Shore is having a summer solstice celebration out at Restoration Farm, which is one of our few organic farms in Nassau County on Long Island. And so we love to do things over at their farm and work together. So that's from 5 to 8 on Saturday, June 17th. On June 17th, City Growers is also having a family farm day at the Brooklyn Grange. So if you can't make it to ours, you can check out theirs. But theirs is actually going to be at the Long Island City location. So if you want to see both, you can come to both of them. Also, coming up July 14th and 16th, it will be here before we know it, Slow Food Nations is taking place in Denver, Colorado. And this is the equivalent of the European Terra Madre that happens every other year in Italy. This is on U.S. soil, though, and it's going to be a huge gathering of food producers from around the world, chefs, workshops, panels, picnics, barbecues, you name it. It's just going to be a foodie weekend all weekend long in Denver, Colorado. I'll be going out there as well. I'll be doing a presentation on our food and film feast to some other Slow Food chapters to try to spread how to do that, because our food and film feast is such a wonderful success. So if you can make it to Denver, Colorado, it will be a fun, fun weekend. I promise you that. There's July 20th, there's a workshop taking place in Washington, D.C. on nutrition for nutrition educators as advocates. And this will be up on Capitol Hill. You can find out more information on my website on all of these things. And then just want to mention, saving the date for August 11th is the Food Truck Derby that happens every year in Bridgehampton. And that's hosted by Edible East End and Slow Food, and helps fund their school garden projects. So that should be a great thing to check out. We found my guest. We actually had the wrong number, so I'm really happy to be able to introduce to all of you Michael Abelman. But I'm still going to have him come on in just a minute. Before he does, I want to share with you my weekly recipe. So this week, as I mentioned before, I wanted to share with you a recipe that I picked up while in Peru this past week. And it is vegetarian ceviche. Super easy to make, but oh my God, it's so great. I haven't had ceviche in years, so it was really a treat. So instead of the seafood, we're using mushrooms. So I started with 12 fresh mushrooms. I cut them into wedges. So I cut each mushroom in half and then each half into like three wedges, so about six pieces per mushroom. I used 3/4 cups of raw pumpkin seeds, but I boiled them for, 5 to 10 minutes. Just to soften them up so they would absorb some of the lime juice that I was going to be pouring on it in a little bit. So boil that up and then drain them and let them cool. Then I used 1 red onion that I sliced into thin slivers, 1 cup of fire-roasted corn. Now, I buy organic frozen fire-roasted corn, which worked great in this recipe, 1/2 cup of sweet orange orange pepper, but I diced up 1/2 pepper, 1 cup of lime juice, that was approximately 6 limes, 1/2 cup of vegetable broth, 2 cloves of garlic, 1 teaspoon of a hot red chili pepper. So the ones that I found, I couldn't find any red jalapenos. I found the these Jamaican peppers that were super hot. I put in 1 teaspoon, and that was plenty. So depending on how spicy you like it, chop the red peppers, hot peppers, really fine, and I put in 1 teaspoon. 1/4 cup of chopped cilantro that I packed in there before measuring. I used fresh lettuce and avocado and tomato as garnish on the plate. And so I just put everything into the bowl, the mushrooms, the pumpkin seeds, the corn, the orange pepper, the spicy red pepper, and the onion. And then I combined in a measuring cup the lime juice, the vegetable broth, and the garlic, added a little salt and pepper, and I poured the marinade over the vegetables and just waited, you know, 5-10 minutes before serving it. I had some left over, and we ate some yesterday as well, and it still was delicious. It was amazing. The mushrooms did not get over mushy or anything like that. It was just as good the next day. So it can be made a day ahead. So enjoy. And that's my recipe. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Michael Abelman. As I said, I invited him on after seeing his most recent book called Street Farm, Growing Food, Jobs, and Hope on the Urban Frontier, although he has authored many other books as well. He was the author and photographer of From the Good Earth, which is a celebration of growing food around the world. Another one is On Good Land, which is the autobiography of an urban farm, and Fields of Plenty, a farmer's journey in search of real food and the people who grow it. And he's also the subject of an award-winning PBS film called Beyond Organic, which is narrated by Meryl Streep. And he's just a real mover and shaker. He is doing amazing things, and I'm going to let him tell us more about what he is doing. Michael, are you with me?
I am. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. And thanks. sorry this morning about the confusion. We had a wrong number. But
sorry, I'm not sure.
I'm glad you're with us now. Before I actually, you know, get going into my questions about Street Farm, I would like to just ask you, how did you get into this? Can you share with us a little bit about your story? What is your background? How did you first come to love food and farming and urban farming especially?
Yeah, well, I mean, I started farming full-time at the age of 18. I'm 62 now, so that's I've lost track. Maybe that's 42 years or something, I think. I left home at 16. I joined an agrarian commune in California, and we had, several thousand acres of land. We were growing food for our own. We had several natural food stores, a juice factory, a restaurant, and we were shipping organic produce around the U.S. It was at the time one of the largest, if not the largest, distributor of organic produce at the time. And I, within 3 months of having joined that commune, I was asked to manage their 100-acre pear and apple orchard. I had no experience, and there I was at the age of 18 directing a crew of 30 people, most of whom were older than I was. The orchard had been abandoned for 15 years, so that you couldn't even see the alleys down the middles of the rows. I had a 1930s copy of Modern Fruit Science, the journal from the guy who ran the place the year before and gave up in frustration, and a copy of Goethe's famous quote, "Whatever you can do, or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it." Attached to the door of my little 20-foot trailer, unheated trailer. And so that was kind of my beginnings. I mean, really, under similar situations, I probably would have run as far away from farming as possible. But there was something that that took place down those rows of apple and pear trees, something very different than what was happening until now in most fields and orchards in North America. And that was that I went to work every day with 30 of my friends. And while we worked, we joked and we talked and we tried out our latest theories on each other. We speculated on, you know, the fate of the earth and the current politics. And so at the end of each day, instead of feeling I had been chained to some mind-numbing drudgery, I felt like I'd been an all-day party. So that was kind of my beginnings, which were essentially the realization that good farming was more than just the combination of good technique and fertile soil. It was the energy of the people who were growing the food, you know, the best fertilizers, the farmers' footsteps on the field. And that was kind of my beginnings. It was a community, sense of community that kind of initiated my beginnings in agriculture, and that's kind of informed everything since.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's how I got to food, too. You know, when you're creating food or growing food, it is so much the energy and the people that are involved in it. And very often when I'm talking to people, I talk about the energy that goes into the cooking of the food, you know, and how different it is if you grow up where your mom has cooked food for you every night and put that love into the food, and, you know, you're coming together around a communal table and talking, and the energy that happens around food that way, as opposed to our fast food nation of just, you know, grabbing dinner every night or eating, you know, even when people bring food in and then, you know, every kid fills their plate and goes to their own rooms and watches, you know, TV or the computer while they're eating. You know, the difference energy is, you know, it's untouchable, and you can't see it, but it impacts our health, I think. It really impacts mm-hmm. us as human beings. And
yeah, no question about it.
Yeah, you know, that's been, I guess, my connection when I was talking about Slow Food before you came on, which is an organization that's very close to my heart. And, you know, and one of the reasons, one of the biggest reasons, I think, is because so much of what they talk about is not just good, clean, and fair food, but it's the conviviality, the communalness of sharing that food together. That is such mm-hmm. a big part of it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's really at the center of the whole thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So now, when you started Soul Food Street Farm, that was not your first experience. I know you first started a farm in Watts, L.A., and also in Goleta, California. Can you share mm-hmm. with us what was the difference when you started the farm, Soul Food Street Farm? That was in 2009.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working as a commercial organic farmer, as I mentioned, since, well, what is it, whatever, 42 years or something. And a good chunk of that time was in California on the same farm. It was a small farm north of Santa Barbara in Goleta, California, that became surrounded by suburban development. It was a kind of a this oasis floating in a sea of tract homes and shopping centers. We were producing an incredible diversity of products. I think it was like 100 different fruits and vegetables. We were feeding 500 families and employing, at its peak, up to 30 people. It was quite a dynamic place. But, you know, that farm became, it was zoned for 52 condominiums, threatened with development. We formed a nonprofit organization, which we called the Center for Urban Agriculture, and that was in the mid-1980s. When you use the words urban and agriculture in the same sentence, that was people looked at you rather strangely. Of course, now there's a international movement around that. And so we formed this organization, and we were given a year to raise $1 million to save that land, which we did. We were successful. And so that place was permanently protected. But in the process, we also engaged in a number of other urban agriculture endeavors, specifically a project that we did at 103rd and Grape in Watts, next to the Jordan Downs housing project. It was about a 3-acre plot, and we developed that into an urban production farm. We supported and participated in a number of other projects in the region. You know, with, I think, mixed success. I mean, my goal was really that I had witnessed in many, especially lower-income neighborhoods throughout America's cities, that there were, at that time at least, a lot of abandoned lots. There were there was an extreme lack of availability to good work, to meaningful employment for people in those communities, and there was had been a major supermarket flight, so the access to fresh food was lacking. And I thought, if we could create one elegant solution to address all of those issues, put them together, maybe we could get somewhere. And so we thought, well, we could take those lots and create production farming enterprises employing people. I think in the early years, you know, I was younger, and I learned a lot of hard lessons, especially that it's a dangerous thing to think that you know what someone else needs.
Right. And we've all learned that lesson the hard way.
That is really... And so I think if you fast forward many years later, starting Soul Food Street Farms in Vancouver, which was only, what, eight and a half years ago, you know, into my late 50s, I came at it with a much more pragmatic, a much more focused, much more realistic and inclusive approach. And we are, you know, in Vancouver, we're working in a neighborhood which is the downtown east side, a neighborhood where the term Skid Row was actually coined. We work with, you know, a population that are almost entirely in that neighborhood dealing with some form of long-term addiction, mental illness. It's the poorest postal code in Canada. And we have been employing them, in training them in production, urban agriculture, and providing employment. We've been doing that, like I say, for over 8 years. We now have people who did not hold a job for 4 or 5 months that have been with us for all these years, folks who've gotten their lives together. This was not an attempt to save anyone or to get anybody off of drugs. It was merely to provide a reason to get out of bed each day and a community to participate in and plants that depended on you. And the results of that have been far more profound than I would have expected. So that's we're producing 25 tons of food on a little over 4 acres of pavement using a very innovative system that we've developed. And so it's a serious enterprise, and it's, I think, had a pretty amazing effect on people's lives.
It's amazing. I've looked into a number of social impact model businesses, you know, who have really addressed the need for some of the poorest communities that you're talking about, a reason to get out of bed, you know, and as you said, you know, not necessarily to clean them up, although some of the other companies do require them not to be coming to work high and things like that, that they have to, mm-hmm. you know, be off of the drugs, at least while they're at work. But it's, you know, it's amazing to how food can really do that in a way that other jobs can't. You can't take someone that has been not working and all of a sudden try to put them, you know, behind a desk and think that's going to work.
Right.
So
yeah.
The whole idea that it's that they're coming at it with a community and working together, I'm sure that adds to the success so much. Now, have you found...
Yeah, and it's the food and the nourishment, but it's also fascinating, the power of living soil to... and it's... physiological impacts on people's mental health. I mean, we had anecdotally and kind of felt this, many of us, for many years. Now there's a number of studies that have demonstrated that, you know, working with living soil affects serotonin levels and other aspects of mental health. And you know, when people have to, you know, when there's plants depending on them and when there's a community depending on the food, when, you know you're needed, when you're doing something that people really... respond to, boy, that's amazing. Very simple, but very effective.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Now, you said you have 25 tons of produce you produce on 4 acres of pavement. You
yeah.
do raised beds? Is that how you do it?
Yeah, we designed and had manufactured it's a plastic box system, which isolates the growing medium from either contaminated soil, which almost every city in the world is too, the native soils are too contaminated to grow food in.
Right.
It's rare that you find them. Or they're paved. So these boxes allow us to grow on pavement. They allow us to grow on contaminated land safely. And they also, the other important thing is that they are set up to be able to move on short notice, because in most American cities, except for in the middle of the country, the value of land is too high for landowners and developers to commit that land to a farm. So this allows us to move. And I think so we've addressed two really important and probably common issues, I think, that exist in most cities.
So do you actually pick the whole bed up and move it? There's a bottom to the
bed.
Yeah,
I mean, we don't, you know, we hope that, I mean, this, we have 10,000 of these boxes. So we
All
hope
right.
that, I mean, the goal is that, you know, when you enter into a lease, that, you know, your hope is you're going to get a minimum of 3 years. But if we have to move it, we have to move our largest site this November. The boxes have forklift tabs on them, and the whole system is movable. It's a project to do, but we're
sure.
not stuck with a situation where we have plants in the ground, which we couldn't anyway. So this appeals to landowners who know that at some point that land is going to be used or developed, and the value of it is, in terms of economic terms, is higher to them as than any farm could ever provide. So we're movable. Yeah,
that's amazing, amazing.
Yeah.
Now, do you find do you have challenges when you're working with a population as you are, with people showing up and coming to work? I mean, I know
Absolutely.
Just by the little farming that I do here on my property, you know, if I'm expecting someone to come where we have a project to do, if they don't show up, it's not good.
In our case, it's really interesting because, you know, our primary mandate is a social one. The agriculture is, of course, important, and we do a pretty amazing job of that, but we're really there to grow people as much as we are to grow food. And so we know that people are going to occasionally fall off the wagon. They don't lose their jobs if they do. If they did, we'd have nobody working. And when someone returns after being gone, the question is not, where have you been? It's, how are you? And those are two very different questions, you know. And so
right.
We have had to establish, I mean, we still have, you know, on a harvest day, when you have restaurant orders and you've got a, you know, picked 500 bunches of radishes and, you know, 100 pounds of salad mix and what have you, the work has to get done. You can't, you know, call the chefs and say, sorry, you know, somebody didn't show up. So we have an employment model that actually allows us, we've always got to have extra people on hand to cover when people don't show up. And that is a common occurrence, really. Or someone shows up and they're not in a state that they can really perform. So, yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, when I was reading some of your bio, I came across the fact that in 1999 you helped turn back Mayor Giuliani's plans to sell off
yeah.
community gardens in New York City to the highest bidders, and you managed to get him to not do that. Can you share that story with us?
Well, to be fair, you know, I was just one piece of that puzzle. I certainly, like with most of the things I've done, they're all collaborations, and so I'm only a part of it. But I, you know, when I heard that Giuliani was threatening to auction off, I think it was something like 700 community gardens, I was pretty shocked by that. And of course, then I found out that it was, to some degree, it was in retribution, because he had been heckled by community gardeners when he was campaigning, people dressed as tomatoes and carrots and stuff. You know? And, you know, I think he's got a lot of revenge in him, you know. So when I heard that this was imminent, I was so shocked. And so I called a bunch of well-known friends and worked with my friends at Green Gorillas in New York, who I are very involved with. You know, it's one of the oldest community gardening organizations in the country, 42 years or something. And, you know, I got Alice Waters and David Brower and Pete Seeger joined us, and who else? Well, Wendell Berry wasn't available, but I think he mm-hmm. sent us a letter, a few other people, and we converged on New York and organized a series of events and press conferences and basically raised some hell. And but in the 11th hour, Bette Midler and the Trust for Public Land came up with, I can't remember, it's been a while ago, maybe it was $11 million, maybe it was more. I'm losing the numbers at this point. But it was really, you know, I mean, it was a community effort. All we did was, you know, often, as you know, people from somewhere else are heard more than the native folks. So I thought, well, if a bunch of people convert from elsewhere, we can at least
be loud enough.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was effective to some degree, and I think, it was a collaboration, and in the end, it was, I mean, Bette Midler was amazing, and the Trust for Public Land as an organization really pulled it together, I believe all those gardens were saved, you know, so at least at the time, I don't know what happened after that.
Yeah, Bette Midler's amazing with her work with community gardens in the city.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing.
And I need to take my hat off to Steve Frillman and Green Gorillas. I mean, really an awesome organization. I was just back there with them recently, and I just am so impressed with the great work they do there. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to get someone on from that organization,
Steve,
too. I have not yet.
Steve's been at it a long time, so he's a force. Yeah, so.
Great. So is Soul Food Street Farm self-sufficient, or, you know, with the selling of the vegetables, does it work out, the model, business model?
Yeah, so we, you know, as a farmer by profession, you know, I certainly did not want to be involved with the project that was going to have its hand out forever, and so we had projected self-sufficiency financially. I think it was our original projections were 5 years. You know, I realized within the second year of being involved with the project that we would never be operating on the same playing field as other farms, just by nature of the people we were employing. And the requirements of the extra needs that were required in order to keep our staff going. For example, we have a breakfast program. We have a financial literacy program. We teach people how to drive. We pick them up from the hospital if they need to, or take them to the hospital if they need to go pick them up from jail. You know, it just goes on and on. And most of our staff will never work at the same speed or pace as, you know, people have been doing this a while. Although we have some really great farm workers now. So we generate roughly about $300,000 to $350,000 a year in earned revenue from products grown and sold, but we have to raise another $300,000 to $450,000 to $400,000 a year to support the social component of our model. You know, but I will say that I was encouraged by a study that Queen's University did in 2013 of the project, where they determined that for every dollar we paid our staff, there was a $2.25 savings to the healthcare system, the legal system, the social system, and to the environment as well, because of the local nature of the production. So I think that, you know, you really have to look at these things from the traditional bottom line tells you one piece of the bigger puzzle, and I think the external values of what we do are quite powerful, certainly the benefit to the people.
Absolutely. You know, they talk about those kind of studies often when it comes to whether it's early birth control, you know, for young girls in schools, in high school, you know, like to pay them, you know, every month that they show up that they're not pregnant and stay in school, that a program like that would save lots of money to the healthcare system and to the welfare system just by getting kids to graduate school and getting jobs as opposed to falling into welfare and that path. I mean,
Absolutely. There's
so many proactive ways that we could help society that we choose not to do. So it's just so heart-opening and encouraging when you find models that are doing it. You know, there's the D.C. Central Kitchen in Washington, D.C., and the bakery in the Bronx, you know, that's hiring people from, you know, similar population that you're working with. And, you know, these programs are amazing.
It's an interesting point because, you know, I think in this highly digital age, we don't see beyond the moment we're in and the immediate gratification that we expect to take place. And I think that you know, and you look at the way the government structures are, and I think, you know, there is very, very little attention paid to long-term, seven-generation thinking. You know, and I think we pay the price for that. We really have a very short attention span, and we have a very short time frame in terms of how we view problems and issues and how we resolve them. And sometimes it's about, you know, the concern is simply, am I going to get elected to the next term? Or, you know, and so I'm so thankful that there are projects like the one we're doing and people who are thinking beyond the present moment, you know. It's important. I mean, we're living in some dangerous times, I can tell you.
Absolutely. So, now, does the city like Vancouver recognize your project and that the money that you're saving them? So do they help fund your project, or no? That would be too amazing.
I love the way you're
asking. Do you have to go out and fundraise?
I love your Well, look, let me be honest. Vancouver is an unusual place, and the current city government is really unusual. I mean, the mayor of Vancouver, who's a friend of mine, Gregor Robertson, was an organic farmer before he became mayor of Vancouver.
Really?
The city manager, Saadu Johnston, was the green czar under Mayor Daley in Chicago, who was in charge of environmental stuff in Chicago. And the entire city council is almost unanimous in their support of green initiatives. So on that front, we are worlds above and ahead of many cities. We have the only greenest city action plan that has actually, a lot of cities have green plans, but Vancouver has a full, I mean, they did a lot of work on this. However, when the broader vision trickles down through a huge bureaucracy, we face the same challenges that anybody else does. For one thing, the municipal codes were never written to address the kind of large-scale agricultural uses we're doing. So our permit costs are it's just incredible, the cost of achieving a single permit. Water costs, it's very difficult to work within a municipal environment that is not established for, never was, doesn't have the language for the kind of thing we're doing. But we do get some support. I mean, the city does give us some money occasionally. A couple of our farm sites are on city-owned land at very, very inexpensive annual leases.
Are you a nonprofit?
We are. We're a registered charity, which is a step in Canada, is a step above a traditional nonprofit in the States. It's we can in fact raise money, so it's not, that piece of it is very difficult, the working within the constructs of especially a city like Vancouver, where real estate prices are probably more expensive than anywhere in the world right now. So it's tough.
Right,
a lot of pressure,
right? Because the areas that you are growing in, are they all just vacant lots, or did you take land that would otherwise be used as, you know, for other things?
Well, when we started this project 8 years ago, there was a lot more available land, but in that 8 years, real estate prices have just skyrocketed. So the pressure on every square inch in Vancouver is enormous. So we're using parking lots, in some cases land that was not usable for anything else, but is now becoming more valuable. So as I mentioned, our headquarters site, our main location, our largest farm, a couple acres, we have to move in the fall, and it has been very difficult to find a new location. The last 8 years have seen the value of even the most undesirable piece of real estate in Vancouver go up exponentially, and we are affected by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I would also think you can't really move your operation outside of the city limits, because then you have problems with transportation with all of your workers getting there.
Exactly. Right? You are really on it. It's funny because this is we looked at that, you know. And you know, there's a lot of cities that want us. I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've had a lot of contact with Manhattan. You know, there's been communication with cities all over the U.S. and Europe, elsewhere, and in Canada. And I don't think Vancouver wants to lose us.
Mm-hmm.
But it's getting much more difficult. And a few of the sites that we were looking at were too far to support the needs of our staff. They wouldn't go travel that far.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Now, is your food, I know at the beginning you mentioned how there's, you know, been the flight of supermarkets from, you know, the most impoverished communities, and we've seen that across the country, and I've talked about that a lot. Is the produce that you're growing accessible and affordable to your community? Because, of course, we all hear about that organic produce is more expensive, and, you know, we have some farmers markets here that, you know, in the desert communities that are not organic, and it makes me livid, you know? It's like, what, they go and feed these farmers to bring the food into these communities because, you know, the other communities don't want it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, 10 years into my career as an organic farmer doing production growing in California, I realized something that was quite disheartening, and that was that the majority of the food that I was growing was going only to a very narrow segment of the society, and that was those who could afford it. And, you know, what I concluded was that, it wasn't the job of farmers who are already struggling to resolve the issues of an economic system that has created haves and have-nots. That's the responsibility of society as a whole. But, you know, and most of the people I know who are farming have to sell their food to the
highest
price
bidder,
get to survive. So this is not an agricultural problem. It's a social and economic problem of the society. Now, with that said, many of us, when recognizing that, realize, well, maybe we could take our skills and help this issue in whatever way we can. And that's where I started the Center for Urban Agriculture and did the project in Watts and elsewhere. And up here, when I began meeting with the folks on the Downtown East Side and a number of social service agencies that were interested in what we could do, they wanted to do everything. They wanted to feed the community, green the community, provide the jobs, you know. And I said, hang on a second, these farms can't achieve every goal, so what's really important? And what we determined was it was the work. It was the meaningful employment. And so we have to sell our food and get the best price for it in order to cover our payroll and meet the half of our budget that I described that is mm-hmm. earned revenue. We give away, I think the most we've given away is maybe 10,000 pounds a year to local soup kitchens. But in some ways, it sounds weird. When I see that much food being given away, I know that's going to take a hit on our employment model. You know, so while it's wonderful we're giving the food away, it's affecting the basic mandate of the project. You know, so our goal is not to give food away, it's to provide the employment, you know. And mm-hmm. so in order to do that, we have to sell the food. Now, you know, look, there's a lot of our food getting into the neighborhood. And in fact, you know, there's a wonderful story in the book, which I close with, which is, you know, a few years ago, our staff on their own decided that the food that they were getting from the farm, which is most of us use the culls or the number twos, that they wanted to share that with their community. These are people who already are food insecure themselves, you know. So on every Sunday, they would take all the market returns and things that we couldn't sell, and they would take them over to this flea market happening in the neighborhood and give that food away to their community members. And I thought that was a remarkable thing. These, you know, it's my experience from, you know, my travels all around the world when I did my first book and other work I've done, that it seems to me that people who are most impoverished often are the most generous, you know, and I've certainly witnessed that in our own community on the Downtown East Side.
Right. Now, what do you do to extend your growing season? Do you do tunnels or,
yes.
you know, think in
yes,
Vancouver, you know, you're dealing with
yeah.
some cold weather, so.
Yeah, well, we have, we use low tunnels, but we also have one of our farms is 16,000 square feet of high tunnels.
Uh-huh.
They're unheated, but it's amazing. In the middle of the city, we have these huge greenhouses, and that's where we're able to do, you know, tomatoes, melons, peppers, all that stuff, and then early season and off-season products, you know. We do continue to operate through the winter, but at a much reduced scale. You know, we can keep growing a number of different greens with a little bit of protection throughout the winter. And there is a one market a week on Sundays in Vancouver that continues through the winter months. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Amazing.
Yeah.
And
cool.
You're even growing some tropical fruit. Did I read somewhere that you're growing persimmons?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we started my favorite site and the one that I continue to be able to be physically involved with. Because, as you know, when you start an organization, even as a farmer, I originally started, I thought, well, I'm going to be out working with the crew every day. And I was for the first year or two. And then, of course, I ended up having to be raising money and doing all this other stuff. But I remain involved with, we have a one-acre orchard at one of the busiest corners in Vancouver, producing everything from persimmons to figs, quince, all kinds of interesting things. Amazing project. These are trees in larger boxes, also in movable boxes. They're now some of them 18, 20 feet tall, 6-8 inch diameter trunks, and heavily productive. And that was a project that everybody was concerned would, you know, the technical aspects of it would be too challenging to pull off, but it's working, you know. And here
wow.
in Vancouver, British Columbia, we're harvesting, you know, 600, 700, 800 pounds of persimmons a year.
Amazing.
That's a subtropical crop.
Right.
It is amazing, really. You
uh-huh.
know, when that fruit ended up on the at the kitchens and the docks of local restaurants, the other farmers were grumbling when they saw the fruit sitting there, saying, "Oh, Soul Foods must be buying these in Chinatown," you know. And I'm sure, I guarantee you, that they have all gone back and are planting persimmon trees. You know? It's amazing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, pretty awesome.
And what about any berries? Do any berries?
Yeah, we do a lot of strawberries. We were going to get into raspberries, but we decided that was not a good plan. Too perishable. So
yeah,
we use strawberries. We can't, you know, by nature of the physical context of the, you know, the boxes and the way we're growing things, you know, we have to stay fairly focused on those things that have high productivity in small spaces and can give us the best return. And so, you know, there's a lot of things we don't do. We don't do winter squash and potatoes and things like that take up
too
less
much
space.
Space,
you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Right. We're almost out of time. Share with me something from your book that you would like everybody to hear about.
Oh, well.
And,
yeah,
and then,
so
of course,
the
your
is,
contact information so people can
yeah,
hopefully donate
absolutely.
To your farm.
Oh, it's sweet, yeah. So the book is called Street Farm, Growing Food, Jobs, and Hope on the Urban Frontier. Wonderful comments from a lot of folks people would know, you know, Paul Hawken and Dan Barber and, you know, Joan Gussow and folks that have weighed in on the whole thing. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't have it in front of me, so I won't read, but there's a wonderful opening quote from a film that I love called The Imitation Game, which is sometimes it's the people no one imagines anything of who do the things that no one can imagine. And I think that's really kind of sets the stage for the book, which is really the story of the people we work with, you know, people like Lyle, who, you know, a long-term hardcore heroin addict who, you know, in fact, jumped off the top of an 18-story building and hit the 12th-story balcony and survived and is now one of our best employees doing incredible work, has found some sense of purpose. Alan, who came to us at the beginning of the project, actually, as a you know, fully into his crack addiction, who has become one of our supervisors and an incredibly talented farmer, really does great work. All the amazing people that we've worked with, very difficult circumstances of their lives and where they've come from, and how food and farming and this project have really provided a sense of purpose and meaning for them, you know. And so we go into all those stories in the book, and a little bit of insight into, you know, how we worked with municipal government to do something on this scale. It's considered, some say, the largest urban farm maybe in North America. I don't know how anybody determines that. But
so is it replicable? Is it a model that people can then take and bring to their own city?
Yeah, pieces of it are. I like to say that, you know, you really have to adopt and adapt, really, and the adapt being the important word, because every climate, every community, every city and set of circumstances are different, so you really have to, you can take, and people are taking pieces of what we've designed and applying it to their own cities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can reach me. I have we have several websites, actually, but www.michaelableman.com, and that's spelled A-B-L-E-M-A-N. Soul Food Street Farms has a website, so that's S-O-L-E, Food Street Farms.com. And those are probably the two best contacts. You can contact the publisher, Chelsea Green, and they have a wonderful website.
Great, and I'll have all these links on my website, too, everybody.
Oh, you're
so
awesome.
If you didn't write it down, you can pull it off of my website. Michael,
awesome.
The work you're doing is awesome. I'm so happy to get to know you and
likewise,
your story.
Really enjoyed
everybody.
Talking with you, Bhavani, yeah.
It's really amazing, and you know, more people need to think the seven-generation way and think, you know, how what we can do now, how that can impact seven generations down and try to turn our world around a little bit for the better. So thank you so much for what you
awesome.
Do.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Real
You're
pleasure
welcome.
Talking with you.
Okay, thank you. And everyone listening, thanks for listening. I'll see you all again next week. Have a wonderful rest of the week. Bye for now. Come here, come here.